This week, the United States Supreme Court hears arguments on whether the state of Colorado can bar Donald Trump from the 2024 presidential ballot.
Is there any better reason for saying that an insurrectionist cannot hold the whole panoply of offices in the United States, but we're perfectly fine with that insurrectionist being president?
After nearly 5 months of conflict in the Middle East, what's the state of the region?
U.S.-led diplomatic activism by Special Envoy Amos Hochstein, trying to mediate, trying to make sure that the tensions that are there at the moment will not lead to an even bigger flare-up.
And how will NASA's new satellite study the Earth? Join us on the Voice of America as we explore the issues in the news. Hello, I'm Steve Miller in for Lori London. In a case with major implications for the November election, the United States Supreme Court heard arguments Thursday on Donald Trump's appeal to keep his name on the 2024 ballot in the state of Colorado. The Colorado Supreme Court recently ruled that Trump violated the United States Constitution and was ineligible to run for office in the state because of his role in the 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol.
The reason we're here is that President Trump tried to disenfranchise 80 million Americans who voted against him, and the Constitution doesn't require that he be given another chance.
That's Jason Murray, the attorney representing voters in Colorado. Both conservative and liberal justices express concern about states taking sweeping actions that could impact a presidential election nationwide. Liberal Justice Alina Kagan.
I think that the question that you have to confront is why a single state should decide who gets to be president of the United States.
And during his term in office, Mr. Trump appointed conservative Justice Brett Kavanaugh.
What about the idea that we should think about democracy, think about the right of the people to elect candidates of their choice, of letting the people decide? Because your position has the effect of disenfranchising voters to a significant degree.
As 2 hours of arguments were heard inside, protesters for and against the former president made their case outside the courthouse.
Trump is a traitor and a liar and a criminal and a predator and a thief.
I was at the Ellipse on January 6, 2021, listening to President Trump's speech until the very end. And he said absolutely nothing that could be construed as insurrection.
And joining us now to break it all down is Joel Paul, professor of constitutional law at the University of California Hastings Law School, located in San Francisco. Joel, having listened to the arguments presented in the Supreme Court, what's your major takeaway?
Well, it's clear that the justices across the political spectrum are extremely skeptical about the arguments that are being put forward by Colorado. And I think the principal concerns that they have are, first, whether, in fact, Mr. Trump can be classified as a former officer of the United States for purposes of the amendment. And I can explain what that means.
Yeah, please, because you would think that the president is an officer of the United States.
Right. And in fact, I do think he is an officer of the United States. But Section 3 of the 14th Amendment is intended to prevent people who have engaged in insurrection, like those who engaged in the Civil War, from ever holding elective office either at the state or at the federal level. And it says that no person can hold any office, a civil or military, under the United States who have previously taken an oath as a officer of the United States. And so the question becomes, is the president an officer of the United States? And the argument that Mr. Trump puts forward is that as president, he doesn't take the same oath of office that other officers like senators and congressmen take. And therefore, it shouldn't apply to him as a former president. And this is kind of a funny argument to make because Mr. Trump is the only man in history who has ever been elected president who hadn't previously held some other office in the federal government that would qualify as an officer of the United States. So that's the first argument. And I think it's a somewhat transparent argument, because just in the common parlance of language, we all think of the president as an officer of the United States. After all, he is the commander in chief. He is the guy to whom all other officers in the military must report to.
So you said first, what are some of the others?
The second issue that, you know, before the court is whether or not this was in fact an insurrection. The attorney for Mr. Trump, Jonathan Mitchell, makes the argument that it wasn't really an insurrection, it was just a riot. And I'm not exactly sure where you draw the line. Some members of the court suggested, as I think Justice Kavanaugh suggested, that really we should leave this up to Congress. Congress should decide what the meaning of the word insurrection is. And that's a kind of funny position for the Supreme Court to take, because historically, of course, it is the court, not Congress, that interprets the law and says what the Constitution means. We don't ask Congress what does it mean when the Constitution talks about due process or freedom of speech. And then the third issue, which I think is perhaps the most troubling, is the question as to who is to decide whether or not Mr. Trump engaged in insurrection. Should it be decided by a state court, as in the case of Colorado, or should it be something which is decided by another court or by the Supreme Court or by Congress?
Can you speak a little bit more about due process and this whole notion of what is insurrection? Because the former president hasn't been formally charged with that crime. There was this case in Colorado which led us to hear, but he hasn't been found guilty per se of insurrection.
Yeah, so one possibility is that the Supreme Court could decide that because Mr. Trump has never been formally charged and convicted of insurrection, that therefore we can't make that determination without a court proceeding. This is a concern about Mr. Trump's due process. Well, the problem with that argument is that Mr. Trump, in fact, did have due process in the Colorado court. They made a determination. They listened to the facts. He had an opportunity to respond and to testify and so forth. And so you have one court's decision that he engaged in insurrection. And then the Supreme Court concern is, well, should we leave it up to one court in one state, or should it be decided on a national basis? And that's why they think the Congress should get involved. Well, I mean, if it has to be decided on a uniform national basis, isn't that the role of the Supreme Court? The Supreme Court, for example, could look at the record of the Colorado court and decide whether they think it satisfies the definition of engaged in insurrection. And if they weren't sure about it, they could always have a de novo review of the facts. They could have a trial in the Supreme Court. They have that equitable power to do all of those things. But it appears that they prefer to just duck the issue. And that's where I think they're likely to come out.
You know, speaking of likely to come out, you know, there's widespread anticipation of when the decision will come out. And in these high profile cases that have election implications, can you, I guess, really briefly walk us through some of the potential timelines? Because I go back to like the 2000 election, right? Bush v. Gore came out relatively quickly. But, you know, what's your take on how long this could potentially take, given that we are already in election season?
This is a really important point, Steve, that you raise, because after all, Mr. Trump's overall strategy isn't necessarily to win these cases, but rather simply to keep delaying the legal process until after the election, in the hopes that he will win the election and can then pardon himself or, in any case, have the cases dropped. In this instance, the important question is the question that is now before the Supreme Court about whether or not the president has absolute immunity from prosecution. Many observers, myself included, think that because the Supreme Court seemed to indicate a unanimity of opinion here that Mr. Trump was not ineligible because of engaging in insurrection, that therefore the court is likely to decide, at least with a lopsided margin, if not unanimity, that the president has no absolute immunity. And in fact, the court doesn't have to decide the issue. The court can simply say, we're not going to take his appeal from the decision of the D.C. Circuit Court, which held that the president has no immunity. If the president has no immunity, then the case that is now before the D.C. District Court can proceed rather expeditiously. It was scheduled to start at the beginning of March. I think now they probably would push it back to sometime in April.
Joel, speaking of that D.C. District Court case, of the two cases, the immunity case and the Colorado case, which one do you think has more significance?
I think the immunity case is clearly more significant because I don't think that there was ever a real chance that they were going to disqualify the president from appearing on the ballot. I just don't think the court will go that far. So therefore, the immunity question is much more important. Once you've stripped the president of immunity, it means that both the state and the federal cases can move forward.
Joel Paul is a professor of constitutional law at UC Hastings Law School, located in San Francisco. Israeli forces carried out deadly airstrikes on Gaza Friday, hours after U.S. President Joe Biden criticized the Israeli response to the October 7th terrorist attack by Hamas.
I'm of the view, as you know, that the conduct of the response in Gaza, in the Gaza Strip, has been over the top.
There's been no public response to those remarks from Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu or the Israeli government by our recording deadline. Meanwhile, Israeli pressed on with its bombing campaign as diplomats sought to salvage ceasefire talks after Netanyahu rejected a Hamas proposal that also envisaged a release of hostages held by the Palestinian militant group because, as he said, it would leave Hamas in power in the Gaza Strip. Now, according to the Gaza Health Ministry, five people in Rafah were killed in that Friday attack. Mohammed al-Nahal tells Reuters that they were sleeping when the attack came. The first rocket hit and they were thrown outside, and the second rocket destroyed the home. Mohammed says that he lost his daughter, her husband, and their son. And speaking before this latest attack, U.S. National Security spokesperson John Kirby says that Washington sees no signs of a major military operation about to take place in Rafah.
The Israeli military has a special obligation as they conduct operations there or anywhere else to make sure that they're factoring in protection for innocent civilian life, particularly, you know, the civilians that were pushed into southern Gaza by operations further north, Khan Yunis and North Gaza. I could tell you that absent any full consideration of protecting civilians at that scale in Gaza, military operations right now would be a disaster for those people, and it's not something that we would support.
Earlier, I spoke with Nimrod Goren, a senior fellow for Israeli affairs at the Middle East Institute. I began our conversation by asking him about Biden's remarks.
It falls in line with the development over the last couple of weeks in which the spat between President Biden and Prime Minister Netanyahu is becoming more obvious. So, you know, the U.S. was granting Israel immense support from day one after the Hamas terror attack on October 7th, and that was really appreciated and very important for Israel. But currently it seems like there is some conflicting interest between how Netanyahu is taking things forward and how the American administration wants to see them advance, and the American leadership, whether it's Biden or Blinken that is visiting the area quite often already also now, are transmitting that more vocally, more publicly, in a way that the Israeli public gets it and understands that this rift actually exists and not only in rhetoric. So I think that's the new phenomenon that is taking place. The goal eventually is to find a formula that will put another pause in fighting for hostage release and for them trying to reshape regional realities in a new direction.
On the notion of a ceasefire or a pause for that matter, where do you see things going? Because that was the whole purpose of Secretary Blinken's fifth trip to the region. And earlier this week, Prime Minister Netanyahu really had harsh words for some of the proposals that were put forward.
There is currently a negotiation process taking place. So there was a summit in Paris involving the Americans, the Egyptians, the Qataris, the Israelis sitting together trying to look for a formula. Now there is a back and forth with Hamas about the reply. Their reply to this formula and the Israeli reply to their reply. So it seems like the sides, putting aside all these statements by leaders that are sometimes very hawkish, very strict, eventually the sides are talking to each other indirectly and seem to be interested in finding some solution. And I guess it will converge more and more as we get closer to Ramadan, beginning in next month, in a way that at least the first phase of this deal that people are talking about, of let's say up to 45 days of pause for the release of about 45 Israeli hostages, that I think is a realistic goal to expect now, that this will be materialized. It won't be an easy negotiation. You will hear statements throughout the next couple of weeks of people saying it will not fly, it will never happen. But eventually there are still attempts behind the scenes to try and make it happen, and the Americans are playing a leadership role in that.
So as you say, the important details will be behind the curtain, so to speak, rather than the overt statements by leaders. One of the things I do want to ask you about is that there is concern that as this continues, there could be regional spillover. And with the Israeli stated push that they want to go through southern Gaza, possibly into Rafah, all the way to the border, what do you see as the regional implications of that? Because the Egyptians, President al-Sisi, has really said that, you know, they are concerned about the implications of conflict really coming towards that southern border.
And that's a very important concern, because the relationship between Israel and Egypt are a strategic relationship for Israel for decades, and it's one that Israel wants to maintain. So again, from early phases of this war, the Egyptians were voicing their red lines, which were basically to ensure that there will not be a refugee flow from Gaza towards Sinai. I think that's still their number one concern. And a possible Israeli attack on Rafah will increase the likelihood of this happening. So there was also a report that in parallel to the talks about hostages and pause, there are also engagement between the Israeli and the Egyptian side about how to make sure that on one hand, Israel can pursue its military objectives, but on the other hand, ensure that this will not entail the fruition of the Egyptian concerns. So I think that's where the sustainability of Israel-Egyptian relations over more than 40 years and the coordination mechanisms that are in place between the security apparatuses could come in handy. So that's one area of possible regional spillover. The other area is, of course, Israel-Hezbollah in Lebanon, which perhaps even is more dangerous because the consequences there will be very grave. But also there we see a lot of U.S.-led diplomatic activism by Special Envoy Amos Hochstein trying to mediate, trying to make sure that the tensions that are there at the moment will not lead to an even bigger flare-up near the border.
And one last question. You brought up Hezbollah, but I also want to talk about the Houthi rebels in Yemen. You know, there is a coalition led by the United States to protect shipping lanes in the Red Sea. But earlier this week, one of the spokespersons for the Houthis said that they feel they've been successful in carrying out their operations because of the impact it's had on global shipping, while the United States continues to carry out preemptive strikes on Houthi targets. So I wanted to get your take on how these activities are impacting the region, especially since these are Iranian-backed proxy groups, both with Hezbollah in Lebanon, as you mentioned, and the Houthis.
That's a new component. In previous escalations, Israel was involved, and we didn't see such things happen from the side of the Houthis. So it's a new thing from an Israeli perspective. It's one that is not only in Israeli interest, as you mentioned, but it's also an international issue, and many countries have the motivation to try and work to confront it together. It also emphasizes the level of regional cooperation between Israel and Arab states that already exist, even in times of war. On one hand, we see the Saudis taking part in military attempts to take down missiles shot by the Houthis. So we saw that the Saudi military basically help ensure Israeli security. And on the other hand, you see this land route, so trade that cannot come to Israel anymore through the Red Sea, go through land, going through Gulf states, including the Saudis, including whether it's the Emiratis or Bahrain, going to Jordan. So that's another way of bypassing this challenge by making the best out of regional cooperation mechanisms that were put in place before the war and are proving to be resilient in light of the Israeli-Arab tensions. And that's not something that people in Israel take for granted, because there was a concern that with the beginning of this war, all this regional construct could not continue operating. And in fact, it actually does, in parallel to all the criticism that is being voiced on Israel by several of the Arab countries in the region.
Nimrod Goran is a senior fellow for Israeli affairs at the Middle East Institute in Washington, but speaking to us from Jerusalem. Dr. Goran, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
4, 3, 2, 1, ignition, engines full power, and liftoff of Falcon 9 carrying NASA Pace. Go Falcon, go NASA LSP.
Thursday morning, NASA, the U.S. space agency, launched its next climate and Earth monitoring satellite. It's known as the Plankton Aerosol Cloud Ocean Ecosystem, or PACE mission. The satellite will spend at least 3 years studying the oceans at an altitude of 676 kilometers. Now, to learn more about what NASA hopes to achieve and how, I spoke with NASA atmospheric scientist Kirk Noblespies on Monday, a day before the satellite's original launch date. What can you tell us about the PACE mission?
So PACE is the next Earth science mission. It will advance our ability to understand both the ocean and the atmosphere, really by having more advanced types of cameras on the spacecraft that we've been able to fly in the past.
So when you say study the atmosphere, you're an atmospheric scientist. So what are the things Correct. That you in general study, and what are the different things that this mission hopes to achieve?
So my core of expertise, I guess, is the study of particulate matter in the atmosphere, which we call aerosols. And aerosols are interesting because there's a wide variety of sources. It includes everything from dust from deserts or smoke from forest fires. But it also includes pollution from humans, or the byproducts of pollution from humans. So we care about aerosols because they're not good to breathe. They can have an adverse effect on air quality, but they also play a very interesting role in climate. And this gets to the other thing that PACE will be measuring, which is clouds. So aerosols can influence the formation and properties of clouds, which control many aspects related to how our weather works and how our climate works on this planet.
You mentioned the cameras that are being used to take these images for the PACE mission. And over the years, I've gone to various government NASA websites and seen amazing pictures from space of Earth. So what can you tell us about how these cameras are different than the ones producing the images that we normally see?
Well, we're really excited about PACE because these are advanced cameras in a couple of ways. In fact, there are three instruments, three cameras on PACE. The primary instrument, which is called the Ocean Color Instrument, is what we call a hyperspectral imager. So if you imagine our eyes are able to distinguish a couple of colors, ultimately we have three different color sensors in our eyes. OCI has roughly 200. So this is able to really tease out very subtle distinctions in color. And we care about color because it relates to properties of the ocean, specifically biology in the ocean, and the phytoplankton, which is algae that lives in the ocean. It helps us distinguish between different types of these particles, which are the basis of our food web. The other two instruments are what we call multi-angle polarimeters. So the multi-angle part means that they observe a scene from different viewing angles. It's as if it's taking multiple snapshots as we fly overhead. It's also sensitive to a feature of light called polarization. And this is something that we can't see at all with our eyes. It has to do with the way that light oscillates, the way light works as a wave. And so that oscillation has a direction to it. And so polarization means we're sensitive to that direction. All of these things help us better understand what's in the scene that we're observing. So the color sensitivity helps us better understand what's in the ocean, and the polarization and multi-angle sensitivity helps us better understand particulate matter in the atmosphere, aerosols, and cloud properties, such as the size distribution of cloud droplets.
Kirk Noblespiece is an atmospheric scientist with NASA. Kirk, thank you so much for taking time out and speaking with us today.
Thank you very much.
And that's all the time we have this week. And on behalf of everyone at VOA, I'd like to thank you for listening. For more news throughout the week, be sure to listen to International Edition Monday through Friday, where you can visit us anytime at voanews.com. Join us again next week for more issues in the news. And until then, I'm Steve Miller.